This panel examines whether there is meaningful opportunity to expand legal counsel for indigent persons in removal proceedings and what those vehicles may be. It also discusses recommendations to policymakers set forth by different groups for ensuring access to counsel. Session speakers include Jeffrey Heeren, Fellow, Center for Applied Legal Studies at Georgetown University Law Center, Asa Hutchison, former Undersecretary, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and partner, the Asa Hutchison Law Group, and Daniel Olmos, Senior Counsel, Access to Justice Initiative, U.S. Department of Justice. Andrew Schoenholtz, Deputy Director of the Georgetown University Institute for the Study of International Migration, moderates the panel. Here's Mr. Schoenholtz.
So I'm Andy Schoenholtz. I'm a professor here at Georgetown Law. I welcomed you this morning. We've had a full day of excellent speakers and panels and questions. And thank you all of those who are remaining here for our last panel. We have excellent experts today to talk to you about a very important topic that Mary Meg really set up for us in some nice ways. That is the right to counsel, new ideas and opportunities for indigent defense. We have three speakers today. To my left is Jeff Heeren. He's a fellow at the Center for Applied Legal Studies here at Georgetown Law. Jeff practiced for a decade in Chicago, and he knows all the ins and outs about representation, and he's done some excellent research on the legal aid that he'll be talking to us about today. To my right is Asa Hutchison, a former member of Congress, the 3rd District of Arkansas, the first Undersecretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and now a partner at the Asa Hutchison Law Group. You can read more, by the way, about Mr. Hutchison and our other panelists in the full biographies. But in order to give them as much time and give you time to answer, to ask and have questions answered, I'm going to keep those introductions short. And to Mr. Hutchison right is Daniel Olmos, who is the senior counsel at the Access to Justice Initiative at the U.S. Department of Justice that you'll hear a lot more about when Dan talks. Now, all of those who are involved in immigration removal proceedings, whether they are immigration judges, trial attorneys, or immigrants charged with a violation of the immigration laws, know the counsel who represent immigrants in these proceedings matter. We've had studies now for more than a decade that have shown very clearly that represented asylum seekers, for example, will gain asylum 3 to 6 times more often than those who are not represented and those who have to go pro se in an adversarial proceeding before an immigration judge. Chief immigration judges going back into the 1980s, and I can remember the chief immigration judge who talked about this in the late 1980s, they have all been in favor of representation in this adversarial system. Both really to make the system more efficient, more effective, and fairer. Imagine yourself if you are a judge sitting in front of a counsel for the government on one side and an indigent immigrant on the other side who has no counsel. It does not feel like, it does not look like, it is not a fair or effective adversarial system. Counsel narrow issues, they play all sorts of important roles. And so today, we find ourselves acknowledging, as we heard earlier, that a significant percentage of those in removal proceedings do not have counsel. And the question is how to address those gaps. There are many good efforts afoot to do that in various ways, but we are very far from solving this major problem. So today we wanted to bring out some new ideas on this, and you'll hear from three different speakers with three different approaches and ideas about how to move this issue ahead. We'll start, to my right, with Mr. Hutchison. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I am delighted to be with you. As I was introduced, I have a variety of background, most of it on the enforcement side of the immigration issue, first as a U.S. attorney in the 80s, and then in Congress I was on the crime subcommittee, and then, after 9/11 attack, I was asked to be the first Undersecretary of Homeland Security, and so ICE was created. I'll never forget the day that Attorney General Ashcroft signed over the old INS, and he said, "Here you go, good luck." And Homeland Security took it over then, and ICE was created, and the Enforcement and Services Division were severed. And I see Doris Miser, who has a long history in that as well, and it's good to recognize her. And so I come at it from an enforcement background. Whenever I left Homeland Security, entered the private sector, I was involved with a Venable law firm here in D.C., but I set up my own firm in Arkansas, and we handle a variety of cases. Some of those include immigration cases. But I had a wonderful opportunity with the Constitution Project, and that's really what I wanted to address today. I was invited to join the Constitution Project, which is a model think tank in which you take members of the left and the right, a variety of political spectrum, folks like me that come with an enforcement background, probably a conservative background, and you join those with those on the left that has a totally different view of life, and you say, we're not going to agree on everything, but are there a few things that we can agree upon to move our process forward, both in the criminal justice area and, in this instance, in immigration detention? And so that's my model of governance, and so I was delighted to participate in this. And one of the first things that came up was the Constitution Project's recommendations for reform in our immigration detention system, and most importantly for this panel, promoting access to counsel in immigration proceedings. Now, this was a little bit of a big pill for me to swallow. As an enforcement guy looking at the right to counsel issues, partly because I know from a congressional background as to the limitations budget-wise and otherwise to moving that issue forward. But I looked at it in terms of fairness, in terms of moving the ball forward. I'm fully convinced that our immigration detention system can work better when we expand the right to counsel and access to legal counsel. Clearly, detention is absolutely necessary in our immigration enforcement proceedings, but you've got to look at instances where you have to expand access to legal counsel. As you know, each year more than 300,000 non-citizens are held in detention. Two-thirds are unrepresented, and some are unaccompanied minors. Some have substantial ties to the United States. The laws are complex. I had an enforcement responsibility. I'm still not sure I understand them all today. And you can imagine an immigrant that is faced with this myriad of laws and the challenge of it. And so we need to be able to expand access to legal counsel. The recommendations that came from the Constitution Project in this regard were to support legislation that would allow immigration judges to appoint counsel for indigent non-citizens in limited cases. And we looked at what cases that should be applied to, and complex cases and standard removal circumstances, particularly instances where children are unaccompanied by an adult and are apprehended, which was over about 8,000 during a year's time, and over half of those unaccompanied minors appear in court without counsel. Also in cases of disability of the immigrant, instances where there's relief sought under the Convention Against Torture. Of course, the judge has to make some determination on the credibility of the allegation. And then in extreme hardship cases, which allows some flexibility to the administrative law judge to determine whether this merits appointment of counsel. Examples would be extraordinary ties to the U.S. or extraordinary lack of ties to the immigrant's home country. Now, if you expand legal access, who pays for that? Again, I recognize the limitations in terms of the government funding these, so we have to obviously expand pro bono representation. And as before I came over here today, I went and met with a young associate at my former law firm, and because I knew that she had been a pro bono counsel in an immigration case. So I went and asked her experience about this, and when I did, her face beamed. She was thrilled with that opportunity. And whenever she got out of law school, she went with a big firm, and she asked to do pro bono work in the immigration arena, and she sought out this case. And she was appointed, and she was appointed to represent a 16-year-old who was a border crosser that was apprehended by ICE at the border. And through the process of time, she was able to obtain Social Security number, driver's license number, employment authorization, and she applied for asylum, which the administrative law judge granted. So this was a pro bono service, an example of it, and it's somebody who, in my small firm in Arkansas, there is a young associate we have. That's what she wanted to do, was immigration work, and so we're looking at that arena. So there are many out there who's willing to do these pro bono services. I think the challenge is what kind of system we put together to make that work effectively, and I appreciate the others and the leadership that they've had in expanding access to counsel. I think we could have, as a recommendation that was included in the project report, a federally funded system that is established for referrals. So they're not funding the payment of the attorneys and their services, but it's a coordination system. That is really how legal services started to begin with. When I started practicing law, you know, there was the coordination of the legal service, but it was still pro bono service that were provided. And I think that would be a huge step forward and something that gradually Congress could warm to. So with that, I'll yield my time, but thanks you for assembling this panel, and I hope we can expand legal service for our immigrant population.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hutchinson. Dan?
Thanks, Andy, and thanks to everybody else for having me here. I work at the Access to Justice Initiative. It was started in March of 2010 by the President and the Attorney General under the leadership of Lawrence Tribe from Harvard to address and increase access to legal representation and just outcomes in both criminal and civil proceedings. And shortly after, and with a concentration across both of those efforts on particularly vulnerable populations, underserved populations, we and I turned our attention very early on in the initiative to access to counsel in immigration proceedings. It was the view of most of the reasonable and intelligent people we talked to, including Mary Meg and lots of others in this room, that the immigration system run out of the Justice Department was about as broken could get. And a large reason for that was that, as we've heard today, somewhere between 80 and 90% of the folks who are detained during removal proceedings don't have lawyers. So access to legal representation in removal proceedings became a priority of our office. And what can a little office in the Justice Department do about this? Well, one of the things that we started was looking at ways that we could support the legal orientation program. You all have heard some about that today. The great thing about the legal orientation program is that while it's giving both sort of know your rights presentations to immigrants in the removal proceedings and also acting as a referral service for pro bono counsel where it's available, it also saves the government a lot of money. It saves ICE tens of millions of dollars every year above what the program actually costs. So, boy, that seems like something that people on both sides of the aisle should be able to support. The second thing that we did was using the kind of bully pulpit and using whatever position of influence Larry Tribe could have or any of the rest of us could have would be to increase the capacity of that pro bono counsel across the country using Larry's name and message to emphasize what you all are emphasizing here today, that this is a critical issue that has reached basically a crisis point for our government. But what we found is that just about everybody we talked to said that this problem wasn't going to be addressed sufficiently unless the government got involved in a more direct way by funding representation in removal proceedings. We heard that from everybody. And that was particularly true with respect to two populations who were most vulnerable. One, the unaccompanied children. Again, some 8,000 of whom are detained in this country every year. And the second sort of population was folks with mental disabilities and other mental limitations. Those are folks who, A, are not going to benefit from Know Your Rights presentations, and, B, you're going to have a really difficult time finding pro bono lawyers for them for obvious reasons in the adult with mental disability context. And with respect to the kids, it's more of a geographic issue. Those kids, most of the, we're not supposed to call them detention facilities, but the detention facilities where, that hold these kids are all clustered in the Rio Grande Valley, sort of far removed from where these lawyers are. So we were encouraged to focus our efforts on ways that the federal government could get involved in funding lawyers in removal proceedings, something that we understood had never happened before. And just like everything else in the federal government, it has proved to be far more difficult than we ever imagined. The first obstacle, many of you are aware, was an opinion, a memorandum written in 1995 by the General Counsel of INS, which at that point was housed in the Justice Department. That memorandum concluded that Section 292 of the INA, which says that folks in removal proceedings are entitled to have lawyers represent them but not at government expense, that meant, in conjunction and when read with other sort of general appropriation statute, meant that the government could never, under any circumstances and even in its own discretion, pay for lawyers in immigration proceedings. That was had devastating effects. That this memo sort of took on a life of its own, both within our department, then when in DHS when that agency was created, and on the Hill. Many of you who have gone to advocate on this issue on the Hill undoubtedly heard about this memorandum, about this legal conclusion. What it basically meant was that absent Congress passing a law saying these immigrants in these particular removal proceedings or more generally are entitled to lawyers at government expense, that the federal government could not spend its own money. And, you know, we couldn't get the DREAM Act passed in the last Congress. The chances of us getting this Congress to pass anything along those lines was, quite frankly, more than I cared to even think about. So the more logical conclusion seemed to be, well, if we could figure out a way to remove this kind of this red light that we had on spending discretionary money on legal representation, there might be a way to do something here, to explore more possibilities. So we started about that process, and it was a long and sort of sordid history that I'm not really at liberty to describe to you. What ended up happening in a very principled move, in my opinion, was that General Counsel's office at now DHS authored a letter memorandum addressed to the Justice Department stating that, in its opinion, current opinion, there is no statutory bar to spending generally appropriated money on legal representation. I can talk about that letter because it's public. Some of you all in this room have seen it. Otherwise, I probably couldn't talk about it. But it is, we hope, the beginning of a move in the right direction here. Now, again, there are lots of possibilities, and this is not by any stretch of the imagination a green light to spend government money. It is merely the removal of a red light. But it has certainly opened up possibilities, along with the other two avenues that I described earlier about supporting LOP and increasing pro bono representation. It has opened up, we hope, another world of possibilities that may and could include the government at long last paying for lawyers in particular kinds of cases where the humanitarian interests are compelling and the government's fiscal interests are compelling. And there is another issue that is relevant here, I think, that I'm not really allowed to talk about, but I can sort of comment generally on, and that is, as some of you are aware, there's litigation going on right now in the Central District of California, Franco Gonzalez versus Attorney General Holder, on the plaintiff's class of mentally disabled immigrants. ACLU is lead counsel, alleging that there is a right to counsel under various federal statutory and constitutional grounds for folks in those particular cases. The district judge in that case in January issued an order on the plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction, setting aside the due process claims and finding that under the Rehabilitation Act, qualified representation is a reasonable accommodation for mentally disabled folks in removal proceedings or that particular class of people. I encourage everybody in this room to follow that case. It could have a great impact on the way the federal government addresses cases involving adults with mental disabilities, and I can't really say anything more about it than that. But that, with the new letter memorandum by DHS, you know, in some ways, I suppose it is an aligning of stars of sorts in thinking about new ways that the federal government could increase access to representation and removal proceedings. At the same time, we are faced with these levels of austerity and fiscal constraints that none of us has ever seen in the federal government, or at least people of my generation probably have not. So in some ways, this hill is just as steep, if not steeper, than it has ever been. But we are hoping that recent developments will make these new possibilities at least more possible. We have to crawl before we walk, I suppose. And I encourage you all, not only this conference, but moving forward in the work that you do to hold my agency and the federal government's feet to the fire on these issues. It really does make, particularly with respect to those two populations of people, so much sense, not only from a human perspective, but also from a financial perspective, for the government to get more involved in the provision of counsel. It could save us a lot of money, and it's the right thing to do.
Thank you very much, Dan. Jeff, are you doing you're doing a PowerPoint, right? Or you have some PowerPoint slides?
Have to do more than just a PowerPoint, Andy. But
okay.
I'm really excited to be here. This is an issue that I care very deeply about. As Andy mentioned, before I came here, I worked for about 10 years as a legal aid lawyer in Chicago, primarily representing immigrants during that time, and representing them in all sorts of different cases. We've talked today just so far mostly about deportation proceedings, but there are all kinds of different ways that immigrants need legal aid in the United States. They have the same types of legal problems as the rest of us. My experience was that this type of work was extremely rewarding. As Mr. Hutchinson mentioned, these are extremely rewarding cases to work on. But it was also sometimes somewhat of a frustrating experience, because I felt like no matter how hard my colleagues and I worked, we weren't able to meet the enormous demand for legal aid in a city like Chicago. And I have a proposal today that I hope will do something to address this problem. My proposal is to empower federally funded civil legal services organizations to represent some categories of immigrants that they're currently prohibited by restrictions from representing. So I think that this is really, in some ways, an interim step before the steps that my co-panelists have described of funding sort of a national system of appointed counsel. This would merely open up additional resources that are not currently in play that easily could be leveraged to provide more legal aid. And by no means is it a silver bullet, again, but I think it is one issue, one argument that should be on the table that maybe is not so much on the table right now. By way of explanation, there are basically four categories, I think, of legal aid that are currently available for immigrants. And people tend to talk a lot about three of those categories: law school clinics, like the clinic that I work at in Georgetown right now; specialist immigration law nonprofits, like the National Immigrant Justice Center in Chicago; and pro bono help from law firm attorneys. I'm not going to say very much about these categories, aside from noting that I don't think they're fully meeting the demand, and also that they're not able to provide holistic services for immigrants. They typically will just assist an immigrant with their immigration law problem. But immigrants often have problems that are both immigration law problems and other types of legal problems, and they're often very closely intertwined, such as somebody who is a domestic violence victim who also qualifies for a form of immigration relief. And those are two separate types of legal issues that need to be addressed. There is one type of organization in the United States that is capable of providing holistic legal aid to immigrants, and these are what I call generalist civil legal aid organizations. I think that they've sort of been written off in discussions like ours because there's a general sense that they're restricted from doing this work. People don't know a lot about the specifics, but they know that there's a problem with them doing immigration cases. I think it's ironic in a way that they've fallen off the radar, because for so much of the history of legal aid in the United States, of immigrant legal aid, they were basically the whole story. It's often forgotten that legal aid began as an immigrant institution. The first two major legal aid institutions in the United States, the Legal Aid Society of New York and the Bureau of Justice in Chicago, were both founded by German immigrants in order to help immigrants with basically the same types of problems that they're experiencing today, problems of workplace exploitation, problems of being bilked in consumer transactions. And they represented a lot of immigrants in those types of cases. As immigration law changed and became more complicated and harsher after the turn of the 20th century, they also started to handle immigration cases, too. They did a lot of citizenship cases, and they even represented immigrants in a small but highly visible docket of deportation defense cases as well. So the intense connection between legal aid organizations and immigration can be seen just from the fact that the majority of the early clients of legal aid organizations were, in fact, immigrants. And over time, as the demographics of the United States shifted and as immigration law became increasingly controversial, that started to change. But by the time we get to the 1960s and the 1970s, there was a renewed interest in immigrant legal aid as part of the war on poverty. In 1974, Congress created the first federally funded nonprofit organization to administer legal aid throughout the United States, an organization that has the somewhat confusing name Legal Services Corporation. It's actually a quasi-federal agency. It's a nonprofit that receives federal funding and then administers that to other nonprofits throughout the United States. So a number of early LSC-funded offices in the 1970s formed immigration projects that not only represented immigrants in individual cases, but also filed some of the most important civil rights litigation of the 20th century. For example, the LSC formed a national support center for immigration work called, well, today it's called the National Immigration Law Center. Some of you are probably very familiar with that organization. It still exists today and is still a leader in this area, but is no longer LSC funded. A lawyer at the National Immigration Law Center was one of the attorneys who argued Plyler versus Doe, which to this day probably stands out as one of the most important, if not the most important, immigrant rights decisions that the Supreme Court has ever handed down, a case finding that undocumented children in Texas had a right to a basic education. Now, unsurprisingly, a lot of this work was controversial, and there was somewhat of a backlash. In 1982, Congress appropriated funding for legal services with a rider attached saying that attorneys could not represent immigrants except for those that fit within certain narrow categories. And those categories, in general, were immigrants that Congress considered to be permanent immigrants as opposed to temporary immigrants. Every year since 1982, Congress has reappropriated funding with the same rider attached. It's shifted. The categories have changed slightly over time. They become increasingly complicated. They're more or less at their core the same. One major change that was made was in 1996 when Congress added an additional restriction stating that LSC-funded offices could not even use non-federal funds to represent immigrants, unauthorized immigrants. So the current LSC restrictions are incredibly complicated, as you can see from this very cluttered slide here that is probably extremely difficult to read. Basically, I think very few people in the United States fully understand them. Most organizations, I think, do not have the time, the expertise, or the resources to fully unpack them. There are a few that do, and that do represent immigrants in very significant ways. I know a bit about the scope of current legal services representation of immigrants, both because I worked at an LSC-funded organization, but also because I surveyed organizations last fall. There are 137 LSC-funded offices, or programs, rather, throughout the United States. And of those 137 programs, 56 responded to my survey. And out of the 56, 63% of them reported that they do, in fact, handle some immigration matters. Most of them, though, do not have a full-time immigration attorney on staff. Only two organizations, the ones in Los Angeles and New York City, have significant immigration projects with about 11 attorneys on staff at each organization. The majority of the organizations that do this work handle what I'll call victim cases. These are basically three major categories. These are cases on behalf of crime victims who are cooperating with law enforcement who qualify for something called a U visa. There are cases of victims of a severe form of human trafficking who qualify for something called a T visa, and the abused children and spouses of lawful permanent residents or citizens who qualify for relief under the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA. Of the organizations that do not do this work, the most commonly cited rationale for not doing it are the LSC restrictions, and 88% of the organizations reported that this was a major factor in their decision. So I want to move on now to talk a little bit about my proposal for reform. And I should say, first of all, that every single organization that I surveyed reported that there was a need for immigrant legal aid in their community. So there's no question that there's a need. And I think all of us on this panel have already been on it in consensus as to that point. I think there are a number of reasons why LSC-funded offices are sort of an ideal focal point for expanding immigrant access to counsel in the United States. The first is that they are probably the major delivery system in the United States for civil legal aid. As I mentioned, there are 137 programs, and those 137 programs have 918 offices. So they have geographic coverage beyond any other nonprofit, any other type of organization, any law firm in the United States. Also, I can tell you from firsthand experience that the staff of these organizations are dedicated experts on poverty law with a deep knowledge of most of the legal problems that poor people face. And many of the organizations, as I mentioned, do already have staff in place who are familiar with immigration law, who know some basics about immigration law, or who are even experts on immigration law. I think that these are formidable resources that could be quickly leveraged to dramatically increase immigrant access to counsel if Congress were to take a second look at these restrictions. And again, because these restrictions are simply in place in a funding appropriation, they're merely year to year. There's no permanent statute or legislation that would need to be amended in order for change to be effected. There are a number of different ways in which this could be done. The first, the most obvious, but possibly also the least politically feasible, would be to simply repeal the LSC alienage restrictions in their entirety. And in the current Congress, I doubt that that is a realistic possibility, so I'm going to move on very quickly to talk about some other options that I think ought to be realistic. One would be to simply repeal the ban on using non-LSC funds to represent immigrants. And this would allow organizations to raise funding without having to spend a single taxpayer dollar to do this type of work. Another option which could be pursued in conjunction with that would be continued piecemeal reform. Since 1996, there have been a number of new exceptions that Congress has carved out, allowing organizations to represent certain categories, new categories of immigrants. These all fall into what I called earlier the victim exception. Again, people who are seeking U visas, T visas, and VAWA. But there are other types of immigration relief where the applicants are also victims. For example, anyone who is seeking asylum in the United States is by definition a victim of persecution in their country of origin. Persons who are seeking temporary protected status are victims in the sense that their country of origin has fallen into a state of strife or disorder, warfare, or natural disaster. So these are other new categories of immigrant victims that could be added on. The problem with this is that it would make an already very arcane set of restrictions even more complicated. So what I would suggest instead is that these restrictions could simply be rewritten with broad language authorizing programs to represent any type of immigrant victim. And this would bring in other individuals too. For example, persons who have been the victims of workplace exploitation, who've been cheated of their wages, persons who have been the victims of consumer fraud. And remember that these are the type of cases that organizations were doing in the 19th century and in the early 20th century. It's at the heart of the mission that legal aid had from its very beginning. So it makes a lot of sense from a historical perspective to authorize this type of work. Some might argue that it is inappropriate to shoehorn immigrants into the category of victim, that a lot of immigrants don't want to be known as victims. They want to be known as rights seekers, as people seeking redress for their wrong, the same as you or I. I think that that's a conversation we should have, but I don't know that it's appropriate for this forum. So instead, I'm going to move on and spend my last couple minutes just addressing some of the arguments that I think could be made against my proposals. So the first argument is that the current system, which privileges so-called permanent immigrants over temporary immigrants, is entirely appropriate, that we've always given special rights and privileges to persons who are here for a longer period of time, and that that's what we should do with respect to legal aid as well. And I think that the argument against this is deeply rooted in our constitutional history. If you go back and look at the 18th century to the Alien and Sedition Act debates, you see thinkers as influential as James Madison arguing very eloquently that it does violence to our system to carve out particular castes of people like immigrants who are entitled to less civil rights than other castes of people, and that that's wrong both because it creates an undemocratic atmosphere, but also because it undermines the balance of power of our different branches of government, that it's wrong to create a class of people in the United States who are entirely dependent upon executive discretion. I think this is a very compelling argument. I'd like to take credit for myself if James Madison hadn't thought of it first. Another argument is that Congress can and should set priorities about how its funds should be used. There's a limited pool of money. Obviously, this is something that we're very cognizant of right now in the current budgetary climate. And Congress ought to be able to say who the beneficiaries should be of its largesse. And I think that this would be a strong argument were it not for the fact that Congress has gone and told legal aid organizations they can't even use outside funding sources to do this work. So Congress has done a lot more than just say how its money should be spent. It said it's made a judgment about the quality and integrity of particular groups of immigrants. And that's wrong for the reason that I just mentioned. Another rationale, I think, comes from the legislative history of the 1990s Congress, the Gingrich Congress. At that time, there was an idea that was driving a lot of policy, which is the so-called welfare magnet hypothesis. And this is the notion that individuals move from place to place in order to take advantage of more generous social welfare benefits in other locations. And I have a couple of responses to this. One is just, first of all, by way of explanation, I think that people made the argument, or at least a few people made the argument, that legal aid was a welfare magnet, that individuals might be coming to the United States illegally in order to take advantage of legal aid. First off, I don't think that there's any empirical support for this argument. A lot of social scientists have addressed it, found that there's very little support for the welfare magnet hypothesis. But even leaving that aside, I can tell you as somebody who worked in legal aid for 10 years that nobody ever came to my office seeking help because it was kind of a neat thing to do, that it was a generous perk. They came because their life was completely falling apart. This is basically a last resort, and it's not a magnet. The final argument in favor of restriction is really the simplest, and that is just that if you want to get rid of undocumented immigrants, you should deny them attorneys to defend themselves in court. And I think that this argument is really over-inclusive, because first of all, there are a lot of people who are in deportation proceedings who might have a right to be here. I represented people during my career who had U.S. citizenship claims that they were successful on. Our clinic represents people every semester who have asylum claims that they went on. And so the point is that in our system, it's a judge that makes the ultimate determination about whether somebody should be deported or not. And you can't simply say that people are per se ineligible to remain in the United States and therefore not entitled to an attorney. Also, I would remind everyone that this restriction doesn't just deny people attorneys who are in removal proceedings. It also denies people attorneys who have been cheated by their employers, by their in consumer transactions. And denying exploited immigrants attorneys to seek redress isn't, at the end of the day, going to make them any easier to deport, but it probably will create a perverse incentive for bad actors to exploit them. And as Justice Brennan recognized in Plyler versus Doe, it's a serious problem for a nation that prides itself on equality under law to have a permanent underclass of persons who don't enjoy the same basic civil rights as others. And this basic principle, I think, should lead us to take a second look at these LSC restrictions and to reform them to increase access to counsel. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Okay, we'll applaud for all three of our speakers. While you're thinking of your questions, and we have a half hour for you to ask questions and engage our experts in conversation, I just want to ask each of them a question. Jeff, while you're still up and it's fresh in everybody's mind, the 1996 restriction that LSC offices couldn't use non-LSC funds to represent immigrants. Do we have any sense of how meaningful that usage was? That is, did it affect a good number of the LSC offices? Were they much more engaged in representing indigent immigrants in the types of cases you have referred to before that restriction?
Absolutely. I can tell you that my program in Chicago had a much larger immigration project prior to 1996. It had more attorneys. It did a whole range of different types of work that basically ended in 1996. A lot of attorneys who were at different LSC-funded offices around the country left their offices in 1996 because they didn't want to stop doing the work that was so meaningful to them. And a lot of them went to other nonprofit organizations or to law firms or even stopped practicing law entirely.
Okay. Asa, you mentioned, you talked about a federally funded referral system, and I wondered if you could just say a couple more words about what that would be like, if the study really talked a little bit about that.
Well, as I was listening to Jeff's excellent presentation, I'm sitting here thinking about my Republican colleagues in the House and what is doable with them. And, you know, I think it's going to take a long education process to change the current environment and the current restrictions. But I think that a step that is positive is what I was suggesting, which is starting out by funding a mechanism for better coordination and referral of and use of pro bono services. And as you ask how it would work, I would encourage you all to take a look at the Constitution Project recommendations. But the recommendations, one would be for the Department of Justice, which they're doing, is to provide greater guidance to the immigration judges. And I think that has been stepped up. But it would be a federally funded system to refer indigent non-citizens in removal proceedings to pro bono attorneys. It would be utilizing existing nonprofit agencies that are engaged in it. And so it would be additional support for those that are currently engaged in the screening process, the referral process. And we handle, you know, I've done volunteer lawyers for the elderly in Arkansas. And, you know, there's a nonprofit organization that does screening and referrals to attorneys that are signed up for pro bono work. Now, so I think that's a good first step in the right direction to expand legal services. And I might just touch on another area. I think it's been mentioned, but I think we ought to develop more the barriers to effective representation. It's been mentioned that our detention facilities are in areas of the country that there's not good access. There's not sufficient attorneys. It's a long ways and interpreters. You also have the challenge that they're being moved from point A to point B, or facility A to facility B, and you lose the ability to talk to your attorney. I think that is something that can be done within the administration, within ICE, which is to make it a factor in consideration of transfers as to their access to attorneys. That didn't take legislative action. It improves access. It's something that can be handled within the current administration, and it is a very important step. I think whenever we invest millions of dollars in building a new detention facility, I think one factor that should be considered among many would be, is there adequate pool of attorneys that can provide pro bono representation? That should be a factor in where it is located and where it is built. Those are simple steps that are doable, that we can move forward and move the ball forward.
Thank you, Asa. And Dan, I wanted to follow up on your description of the light system. So it's the red light's gone. So where are we? What does it actually mean? What does it allow us to do? I mean, if you could imagine, if the red light is gone, what sort of things could the Justice Department do? Given what I said, which is that the chief immigration judges, for now more than two decades, have wanted to have counsel on that side of the courtroom.
So when I said that it removed a red light but didn't necessarily turn on a green light. The issue now is essentially to find all the money that the Justice Department gets is authorized and appropriated by Congress. So if Congress says, Justice Department, you shall spend $6 million a year on a legal orientation program, the Justice Department has to spend $6 million a year on the legal orientation program. Eric Holder can't decide tomorrow, you know, I don't really like the legal orientation program. I want to spend $4 million of that money somewhere else. So the trick is to find a pot of money that is that the authorizing language that Congress has used is broad enough that one could use a piece of it, a part of it, to fund legal representation and not get into an appropriations mess that there's going to be a big enough target, presumably, on any project that you start to begin with. What you don't want is an allegation that you are inappropriately using money that Congress has authorized and appropriated for this purpose. So the trick is both to find what that particular pot of money might be, look at the authorizing language, and then figure out whether that program either is willing to release some money or whether some of that money is could be used because it's not otherwise being efficiently used. Now, some might argue, and some people in this room have said to me, that, well, the legal orientation program saves ICE money. The Justice Department gets $6 million for the legal orientation program. It saves ICE $50 or $60 million a year in detention costs because it increases system efficiency such that immigrants who have the legal orientation program, their cases last on average 13 days less than those for immigrants who don't have the benefit of a legal orientation program in their detention facility. Why shouldn't ICE pony up some money? Some of you have asked me that, and the answer that I've given you is I don't know. I don't work at ICE, so that's the trick: finding where an appropriate pot of money is, and then convincing whoever has that pot of money that this would be a good use of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we are now open for questions. Now, let me remind you that your questions will be recorded, so please make sure to introduce yourself, tell us your name, your affiliation, speak clearly into the mic, make sure it's on. Okay? So we have a hand up on this side. Thank you, Lisa.
Hi, my name is Farzana Hashmi. I run an immigration program not too far from D.C., and I have some thoughts I just wanted to share with the panel and others and get feedback. But an important barrier I see for volunteer attorneys in removal proceedings is a lack of limited appearances, and I don't know if you've thought about that, but I'd love to see someone address that. Another thing that I've wanted to see is mandatory electronic access to detainees. And then finally, perhaps some thought or some discussion about lo bono as opposed to pro bono. So having done court-appointed work for 3 years, when you do court-appointed work, there are some things that come along with that system, usually in state work. There are case caps, so a contested China, child in need of interest, case on the record would be, maybe $2,000, right? And that's the case cap. That's the most a court-appointed attorney could earn. There are other things that come along with that, but since the vast majority of the immigration bar is solo, it's an important economic way for people to stay in business if they devote a certain percentage of their practice to court-appointed work. And so those are three things that, come to my mind, and I'm a nobody, but that don't involve reworking money necessarily at the congressional level. And I don't know if any of you have thought about that, but certainly limited appearances. I run an immigration program, and every day I volunteer attorneys who want to sign up to do naturalization, who want to sign up to do adjustment of status, who don't want to step near a courtroom. And every day the people who come knocking who need service, the most service, are detainees and people in removal proceedings. And I can't seem to match them. And one important way for me to fix that would be to have limited appearances, where the volunteer attorney could do the paperwork. And then, you know, the rest of the system would, at least if the cases or the issues are lined up in a paper format. And lots of states have looked at limited appearances. I know a state where I'm licensed authorizes it. So I just wanted to throw those three out.
Thank you. I'm going to ask our panel to respond. Could I just ask you one thing? Why don't they want to go into immigration court? It's a great experience. Right? No, seriously, is there? Do you have a sense of why people don't want to? Okay, all right. Anyway.
She said access to the.
Yeah, so lack of limited appearances.
So I can address that first one. The Executive Office for Immigration Review has a rule that a lawyer cannot enter a limited appearance. There is no discrete task representation. A lot of what I've heard since I've been in this job from pro bono lawyers is, boy, you know, my firm would love it if I could go do a bond hearing, but they don't want me to get involved in a 12 to 18 month morass where, you know, I'm not going to be able to extricate myself. And that is, you know, I have a tough time imagining a more attractive opportunity for a firm lawyer looking to do pro bono work than to do a bond hearing. It's a limited period of time. You get to do some investigation. You get to have a live court hearing. You get to cross-examine witnesses. You get to present evidence. It would be an amazing opportunity to increase the pool of pro bono lawyers. So these are times when I have to be careful about how I say things because I work for the Justice Department. That is certainly an issue we are looking at and certainly an issue that my office is concerned about, and we don't write EOIR's regulations. But I appreciate that it's a wonderful idea, and it's one that we've heard a lot about.
Jeff, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I would agree both with Andy that immigration court is a wonderful opportunity, but also agree with that it's kind of a morass. And I think that it would be a good thing if there could be limited appearances for bond hearings. That would obviously bring people more people in. There are some people who have relatively simple cases for bond. On the other hand, there is few areas of law that are more complex than immigration detention. And actually, what seems like it could be a relatively simple appearance could quickly turn into a BIA appeal, a potential habeas corpus petition. So I just want to add a note of caution that there is virtually nothing that is simple in immigration court. And this is another reason why we need more than just limited appearances. We need more than pro bono. We need some sort of wider societal effort to increase access to counsel for immigrants in proceedings.
Did anybody want to address, there were two other issues you had named?
Well, I was just curious on the access to detainees. I assume that is that, would you describe the limits on your access? So you're not limited in going out and physically visiting them, but you want different means of access.
Yes, either video or phone. And it'd be easier then, I think, for me to get pro bono counsel to represent people who are detained.
Well, I think that's well stated. To me, these are things that obviously there's issues from an ICE perspective in terms of cost, of management, of their personnel, but you know, there's got to be some discussions on those. And my experience has been with ICE that there's some accommodations, some adjustments that could be made that are minimal on the cost side but still can accomplish some things. So I just think those discussions need to take place.
I think that there is in the detention standards provision for telephone access to detainees – And I know from personal experience there are problems in implementation, but as a, I think, matter of policy, ICE acknowledges that you have that right.
Thank you. We have a question over here. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Matthew Archibald. I'm a private immigration attorney from Philadelphia, and I love immigration court. I love it. But it's really burdensome, especially when you're looking to detain setting. Mm-hmm. You might be looking at 4 or 5 full days out of the office over a period of time, and as a solo, it's hard. It's hard. I do a lot of pro bono, both agree to and not agree to. That's the nature of the work. But my question is, or my idea is, can we mandate that immigration judges, for pro se clients, people who are not represented, that they do make some effort to find out if relief is available? There are some great immigration judges that do this, and there are not so great immigration judges that won't. I've seen cases of people who have been deported, who have orders of removals, who are in front of an immigration judge that had been here for 14 years, had 3 U.S. citizen children, and no criminal history. And the immigration judge ran them through the system. The ICE attorney sat there, didn't do anything, knew that they had to know that they were eligible for a relief, and didn't say anything. And I would think we can do an immigration consultation in 5 minutes and basically determine if someone has relief or not. It'll be imperfect for the immigration judge, because they're not going to be able, because sometimes it takes more than 5 minutes. But the very basics, I think they should be mandated to do, and that doesn't affect representation or any of these things that we've been talking about. It's just a matter of fairness.
Thank you. Would anybody on the panel like to respond?
Well, I'm certainly not going to dispute your point there. I think that ICE counsel has a duty when they see something unfair happening to particularly whenever the immigrant is not represented, to raise it, and their goal should be fairness in that system. But it just goes to illustrate that, without the adversary system really in place, you're not going to have substantial justice accomplished. Let me just add one other point. Do you specialize in immigration? Is that all you handle? See, this is – you do pro bono – as you said, what, forced or otherwise, or voluntary and otherwise. When we need to expand pro bono services, it shouldn't the burden should not follow on you. The burden of more pro bono services should fall on law firms that handle it might be commercial litigation, but they want to do pro bono service. We need to encourage them to step into the immigration arena. I think that's a lot of education that this bar can really help accomplish, but we need to look to the bar associations in the different states to really push that area of pro bono service. And many of the immigration facilities are in large metropolitan areas, but ICE has built many of them in rural parts of the country, and the immigration attorneys aren't there, but we can train more people. So that's just a comment that you didn't ask for, but I wanted to give anyway.
Thank you, Asa. Any other comments from the panel?
I'm just going to say briefly, it's an issue that cuts across for pro se representation in every proceeding. It was one thing that drove Larry Tribe bonkers when judges, not only in immigration proceedings but also in other civil proceedings, would claim that these pro se litigants are overrunning my courtroom. They don't, all the judicial canons that I'm aware of, the ABA and otherwise, allow judges to, in pro se, when there are pro se litigants in their courtrooms, to take some measure of sort of responsibility over, they can't obviously represent the person, but they are permitted to take a couple of steps in assisting a pro se litigant. So, it's something, I don't know, do you have your adopt ABA, the ABA judicial canons? I guess that's one possibility. The other is just sort of a larger education campaign that, people in this room could certainly take part in.
In fact, immigration judges are already obligated to develop the record in immigration proceedings and determine whether somebody is eligible for relief. But I think this simply underlines the fact that in an adversarial system, it doesn't really work to rely on the judge, that both sides really need to be represented by counsel.
Tara?
Thank you. Tara Magner, I work for Chairman Leahy on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Mr. Olmos, I wanted to ask about the letter memorandum. I think it's fair to say the existence of that document has been rumored but is not well known. Not many people on the Hill know about it, so you may regret talking about it today in public. But what are the plans for that document? How will that be implemented? Will the Office of Legal Counsel issue a memorandum on that? Or, you know, what is the intended reach of that? And then if I could ask Mr. Hutchinson a question, what is your best advice for slowly but surely convincing your former colleagues in Congress on the merits of the type of reform that Jeff has described? And Senator Leahy has a provision of a bill that's very similar to what the Constitution Project recommends, but we've had precious little luck moving that forward. So whether it's empirical evidence, proof of cost savings, what do you think might resonate? Thank you.
Dan, you want to go first? You're not in trouble here. Don't worry. This is Georgetown Law School.
Right. No, Senator Leahy, first of all, has been wonderful on these issues, and his staff has been so great on these issues. There are no current plans that I'm aware of for OLC to do anything. Our office views that letter memorandum as simply the removal of that original 95 memo. So it's as if that never happened. I know what I think a fair reading of 292 is, in read in conjunction with 53106. And I think that the reason we began looking at that issue was because we thought that a fair reading of those statutes was not that which was put forth in that 95 memo. So we don't, again, we don't see that the new letter memorandum to be a green light, go ahead, spend whatever money you want or can find. There are going to be issues when and if we do identify a pot of money. The best thing in the world would be if Congress were to specifically authorize this. I know that you all have proposed that. So we cannot use that new memorandum as a sword. I think it is merely opens the door to possibilities. It doesn't directly present us with any.
I'm glad you asked me, Sang. It gave me a chance to think about it. I think there's three issues that will concern some of my former colleagues. One is the cost that you mentioned. I think in this environment, everything has to be cost effective, and you got to be able to make your case in terms of that. Secondly, in terms of the efficiency of the system, that you're not going to, because you're going to have counsel representing immigrants in these proceedings, that you're going to clog the system. It's going to be a 4-day hearing instead of a 2-day hearing. And that, I think, you show the efficiency through studies, through the judges' comments, through some assurances. And then the third part of it is the politics back home. No one wants to be perceived as somehow, weakening the system or opening the door to those that are unlawfully here in the country. And so I think that you have to incrementally approach this. And to me, the obvious place that meets all of those goals is the counsel for unaccompanied minors. I tell you, anybody can stand all day and defend themselves on making sure that children are protected and have their rights protected in court. So to me, you've got to go at it incrementally and be sensitive to the cost issues.
Thank you, Asa. We had another hand up on this side. Am I right? Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Tanisha Bollins. I'm from Clinic with the National Pro Bono Project for Children. So to the panel, thank you for your insightful thoughts and comments. But I want to direct my question to Jeffrey. I wanted to find out if you've received sort of any feedback about your proposal, if there's buy-in or thoughts about feasibility of it being implemented. And then also the second part of the question is, the second part is how do you envision it being carried out? So, and particularly in most cities, you have LSC organizations and you have other nonprofits that do immigration work. So they're usually on different sides, not different sides, but opposite sides of the fence because of the funding. So how would you envision those organizations working together to serve the bigger goal? Thank you.
Thanks. As to the question of feedback, today is really the grand unveiling of my proposal. So, so far, feedback has been positive. I have heard from individuals who've I've spoken quite a bit with individuals who've been lobbying this issue in one respect or another for years, even going back to 1982 when the very first restrictions were enacted. And I understand that there have been some difficult times. So I do think that any reform in this area is difficult and complicated and will not be easy by any means. In terms of, I think, if tell me if I understand the last part of your question correctly. Are you, you're asking how it would play out in terms of nonprofits sort of coordinating and how some allowance of LSC-funded organizations doing this work might impact other nonprofits that are receiving other sources of funding? How would they work together? I mean, my experience was always that I was working as part of a coalition of organizations in Chicago that did immigrant direct services that included both my LSC-funded office and offices like the National Immigrant Justice Center in Chicago. And I always felt like we had a positive relationship, so I would hope that there would that would remain the case if these restrictions were reformed. Does that respond to your question?
Go ahead. You can follow up for a moment.
It does respond to the question, but I think Chicago is a very good situation, but there are other places that may not have coalitions or may not have an aligned working relationship with all of the nonprofits. Like, not that there's tension, but certain organizations kind of divide what they do. LSC will work on, you know, the housing issues and the other issues, and then, for example, like a Catholic Charities may work on other, just the immigrant claims or the immigrant cases. So more towards the coordination, but that was the question.
It's interesting because if you look back at the history, I think a lot of this balkanization came about through the impact of the restrictions and what led to a division of what had previously been a more centralized system. And maybe there are advantages to that decentralization that I haven't really fully looked at. So that's an interesting question. Thank you.
Yes.
My name is Laurie Persh. I'm with Child Help. And I want to get back to identifying victims and the their rights and obligations to them. And I was also about the screening for who might be eligible for relief. So, for example, someone over here from Philadelphia said that he could identify if someone might be appropriate for relief in 5 minutes, and I would take issue with that as a mental health counselor. I know many, many, many cases of people who have relief histories based on the trauma that they've experienced and are so afraid to reveal what's happened to them because of the lack of trust and because of being tossed around or being, they go from attorney to attorney if they get to see attorneys, that they don't reveal what their history is that might make them eligible for relief, and it might take a while to get to know that. So I think that's an important thing to consider. And so sometimes when we are screening for eligibility, I don't know how we can make allowances for that. Another issue in screening for eligibility, I liked Jeffrey's broad definition of victim. I'd like to know if how you would you account for people who might not meet the regular definition of what even you talked about for victim, but we've set a precedent for them to have the right to live here. They've lived here since they were 2 years old, but they're still being labeled as illegally here. And there have been so many generations of undocumented migration that there are a lot of grown-up kids now that maybe, you know, that right now they don't have access to legal aid to try to pursue legal relief because they don't have the same kinds of claims, but they grew up here.
Thank you. Those are all good points, and I think that there's, as you pointed out, a wide policy debate on this issue, on the question of who should be authorized to remain in the United States. My purpose was definitely not to really enter that fray. I was simply trying to set out what I thought might be a politically feasible standard for authorizing LSC-funded organizations to represent people. I didn't mean to say that people who don't meet the definition of victim that I set out shouldn't be entitled to remain in the United States. And there are forms of relief, as you pointed out, that some people are able to tap into, like cancellation of removal. This is just such a complicated issue. I don't really even know what else to say about it.
We have time for one more question. Mary Mix, since you introduced the panel well in the last session, I want to thank you for that.
No problem.
To ask the last question.
Well, thank you. I think this is really exciting, and I think all of the different perspectives that have been presented are very innovative and thought-provoking and provide us with an opportunity to think about how we move forward. And in terms of ensuring access to counsel, meaningful access to counsel, I think one thing we have to think about in this, and I know there wasn't sufficient time for this conversation, but how to improve the immigration court system simultaneously so that it goes hand in hand. We work with a lot of pro bono attorneys from the large firms that you recommended, Mr. Hutchinson. And, you know, for them, it's become more and more difficult as the courts have just, you know, been exploding with cases, and their dockets are getting heavier than ever before, both detained and non-detained. So for the pro bono bar, that's been a real problem. In fact, one of the major firms just refuses to take any cases right now in immigration court. They'll take the asylum cases in the asylum office. But I think, you know, in order for this to move forward, we have to think about, you know, how we really is, and I think there's a willingness within the Department of Justice and EOIR to do that, but how to give them the little impetus now. And again, it's kind of like my call to urgency on the detention reform. I think, you know, it's a unique opportunity to really look at this. And, you know, like we see in the federal court or state court system, there's pretrials, there's, trial attorneys, ICE attorneys looking at the files before the hearing. People don't come to the courtroom from the government side without the file, unprepared. I mean, we lose pro bono attorneys that way. So the more we can really instill, both within Department of Homeland Security and DHS, a more professionalized immigration court system, I think it helps everybody, including the judges and the trial attorneys. So I would highly recommend that being part of the conversation and dialogue.
I think that's an excellent concluding point that you made. I would just add, and I don't know enough about all the coalitions that are made up in this room and who are all the great voices for improving immigration policy, but there needs to be, of all the suggestions made on this panel and previous panels, a fine-tuning so that you limit the agenda and the message to 4 or 5 points or 4 or 5 achievable objectives, and then you're united going after them. Some of them are very doable, like you said, with ICE and with Homeland Security, better education, some things that they can retool. Some of them are on the Hill. But I hope that there's a good leader that can coordinate all of that and be a good voice.
Before I thank our panel, I do want to just take a moment to thank my wonderful colleagues at MPI and Clinic who've made this conference a success. And particularly I want to single out Lisa Dixon, who's on the side and really was tremendous in organizing this. And now please join me in thanking this panel for an excellent discussion that I hope has provided new ideas for you.
For more information, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/U.S. immigration.